Blog Talk Radio.
Listen to your friends and welcome to the World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At the World Transformed, we will introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermeister, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I am doing great. Kicking off another week here, and glad to do so. We got a great show here, climate and energy tonight, right?
We're doing a wacky theme this week. Before we jump into it, I do want to say, it's just a week till Halloween, so I don't know. Should we do a special Halloween show next Monday?
Well, I think that'd be cool because we will have our show on Halloween Day. We typically do Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Halloween falls on Monday next week, right? So
yeah, it just occurred.
Why not?
We're doing a show on Halloween, so we got to think. We got to put our thinking caps on this week and be thinking about what kind of spooky. That might kick off a whole Tales of the Paranormal week. The fact that we're starting on Halloween, I don't know.
We try to do the 80-20. We're positive guys by nature, and so we spend more time on the positive news, and it's needed anyway. I mean, news is negative all the time as it is. So we really hit the positive, but just to balance it, we do try to hit the negative every now and then. So maybe the spooky news could be the stuff that's somewhat downer, but we'll find the silver lining even in downer stories if we choose to go that way on our spooky week.
So absolutely, or we might go Men in Black. Bigfoot,
we could do Tales of the Paranormal the entire week if we wanted to.
There's a lot of great options.
We've neglected that aspect of our show for too long.
We have. It might be good to do a whole week and bring it back. But hey, I'm excited about this week because, as you said, we're going to be talking about climate and energy. But all this week, we're talking about surprising news and crazy questions. Okay, so this is an interesting kind of formula that we've put together here. We're taking news headlines, news stories that in and of themselves kind of spin things off in a new direction and are interesting in their own right. But then when you start thinking about them, you go, well, wait, what does this imply? So we're gonna look at some interesting developments that we might not have expected. And then we're going to take it up a notch. We're going to ask some crazy questions about these developments. We're going to ask if they imply what we think they might imply. And tonight we're going to focus specifically on some climate and energy stories that raise some that speak to some unexpected directions and some really crazy questions that we can ask in relation to them. The first one is a real callback to a show we did just a week or so ago when we were talking about climate change, and we'll get to the climate aspect of this in a minute, but just on its own. As an energy story, this is quite exciting. The headline is, "Scientists Accidentally Discover Efficient Process to Turn CO2 into Ethanol." And this is pretty amazing. They went out looking for some set of procedures that chemically they could use to take CO2 and turn it into ethanol. And like the first thing they did, which was going to be the prep stage, after which they were going to apply all their different treatments, that worked, right? It turned the CO2 immediately into ethanol. It's like, hey, this is easier than we thought it was going to be. Not only did they get to a result much faster than they expected, but it looks like a fairly easy to implement process. Looks like it would be fairly easy to implement in a widespread way, and it looks like it would be scalable, something that you could do on a very large scale. And since, hey, there's an awful lot of CO2 out there in the atmosphere, and since ethanol is a commodity that people pay money for, this sounds like, this idea has some legs, huh? This idea might take us someplace in this world. What do you think?
Well, I have a number of questions about it. One thing I would question is there sufficient CO2 density in the atmosphere to where that could be the source of the CO2 for purposes of producing this ethanol? Or would you go to some other source of CO2 before, you know, just trying to get it out of the atmosphere?
Yeah, what else would you might pull it from water, I guess, or I guess there's lots of different places you can get CO2. There are ways of synthesizing it from the atmosphere, right? That's where you get the CO2 cartridges, right? Those are
right.
There's some method for distilling it down out of the atmosphere, but that's an interesting question because then you've got this kind of net ergs, right? Net power issue related to it always seems to crop up whenever
you sufficient
let ethanol.
Density in our atmosphere to make it profitable to pull it from the atmosphere in order to make ethanol, right?
Yeah, we know
that'd be pretty great, wouldn't it?
And that's actually our first crazy question. Could this be the turning point in the viability of ethanol as a fuel? Because if what you just said is the case, right, if it's sufficiently dense in the atmosphere that you can pull it out and you can put it into a form where you can turn it into ethanol and the ethanol is going to provide you more energy than you just spent pulling the CO2 out of the atmosphere.
Getting it, yeah.
Yeah.
If you got a net gain there, then that, hey, you might be onto something there, right?
So. Yeah, you might be onto something because we know that you can do things with ethanol. You can, you know, burn it in car engines, for example, and there are lots of other things you can do with it, too. You can drink it.
Right.
You know, I pointed out on Facebook. And
it's for the children, guys, you know.
Yeah, well, something for the kids. We'll drink the ethanol, okay? Keep it out of their hands. But we're
trying to live in a better world.
It's because we care, okay? That's why we do it. But it kind of – those first two questions are kind of wrapped up around each other, right? Which is of our crazy questions. The first one is, could this be a turning point in the viability of ethanol as a fuel? And the second one is, you know, is this going to be the end of grain-based ethanol? And it would be, I would think, if you get ethanol more efficiently this way than you do from taking it from grain. And since there are those who will argue that getting ethanol from grain is one of the least efficient ways to get energy into a fuel, that in fact some say you spend more energy distilling the ethanol, you know, and carting it around than you get out of it, right? I've heard that argument made before.
And the reason we continue to do it is, you know, it's subsidized, right? So,
right.
And so we end up taking food, corn, things like that in this country, and instead of sending it to hungry people who need it, we burn it in our gas tanks, you know, at taxpayer expense, too. So it's probably not the best way to go about it. What if we could pull all the ethanol we needed out of the atmosphere instead, making it, you know, taking care of that little global warming problem and, you know, increasing the food supply for people who need it. So, no, hey, it's kind of a win-win-win, isn't it?
Absolutely, it is. And it throws you right in line for that next question, which is, would we soon have to worry about too much CO2 coming out of the atmosphere as people start to cash in, right? What happens, right, if suddenly we're depleting the CO2 levels in the atmosphere too rapidly, right? You know, it's just imagine there's this gold rush of ethanol in the atmosphere, and everybody's doing it to get the alcohol out of the atmosphere through this process, which does prove to be efficient. You know, do we kick off an ice age potentially by?
Well, Phil, I think this might be the craziest question of the night, because if there's anything
you haven't got the question
to be good at, you know, is putting CO2 in the atmosphere. You know, we're quite well equipped to do so. If it's too much coming out, we can certainly crank up the coal factories a little hotter, right? So.
I think so. Yeah, we should be able to, and that's kind of where I go with question four, which is swinging it back around to the this is where the show where we talked about climate engineering a couple weeks ago comes in. You know, if you look at that climate control scenario, maybe here's my scenario now for our first implementation of climate control. Maybe it'll work like this: we pull CO2 out of the atmosphere to make ethanol, to cool things down. Then it starts to get too cold, so we start pumping CO2 back into the atmosphere, which, as you point out, you don't have to worry about. We can always do that, right? I mean,
right.
Just get a bunch of tires and set them on fire, right?
All those are notoriously hard to put out anyway. To do now, just do those things, and then we have problem solved.
Exactly.
If that ever becomes a problem.
Yeah, just, you know, stack up a bunch of coal and just start burning it relentlessly until the CO2 levels get back to where we need them to be. But I wonder if one day we really do have a, you know, full measure climate control process in place, whether the first step won't be something around that. You know, whether that's the first valve we control on the climate is easily taking it out and putting it in. And this is one of the better ways I've heard to take it out, right? I mean, because there's like this economic incentive over and above all the other good reasons to do it. You know, people will do it just because they want to get at that alcohol, which will have its own value. So that's a crazy question.
A quick aside.
Yes.
You know, this reminds me vaguely of what the Nazis did during World War II. Their fuel supply was cut off. And so what did they do? They figured out a way to produce fuel from coal, liquid fuel from coal. It was it's kind of an inefficient process, and so it's hardly ever used in the more modern world. And I saw an interesting story about a week or two ago. China is opening one of the first Nazi fuel plants in Inner Mongolia. They're because they've got so much coal.
Right.
They're using that to try to reduce their dependency on foreign fuels. I thought that was interesting. But wouldn't it be great instead of turning coal, which is just carbon, into liquid fuel? Hey, you know, we got plenty of carbon. It's up in the air. Go get it. And
exactly.
It'd be great if this was efficient enough to make this a carbon neutral thing instead of pulling carbon out of the ground to make fuel.
There is this process now for turning CO2 into ethanol. You know, ought to be some, all hydrocarbons, right? You know, there ought to be some way to take any piece of carbon and turn it into ethanol, you would think, right? Because CO2 is just carbon and oxygen, right? So, I mean, again, you run into this, you might have to do such a Rube Goldberg kind of device to make it happen that you end up spending more energy than you get. That's always going to be the thing you have to look at, especially with ethanol, which is not that powerful of a fuel, right? It's not that...
I think that a gallon of ethanol has maybe two-thirds the power that you would get in a gallon of gasoline, which is why if you're fueling up with ethanol in a flex fuel vehicle, you're not going to get the same range. And it's cheaper fuel, but you'll be taking more trips to the gas station, which is fine.
Exactly.
Anyway.
A lot of factors there to look at. I hope as they're unrolling their plans in China, they start asking some crazy questions about what they can do next, because I think there's a lot of possibilities that open themselves up. Okay, now here's another one. Here's another very unexpected news story. To me, I guess this has been going around, and I haven't seen it. But this is Matt Ridley gave a talk here at the he was at some summit, and this is actually. If you follow the link here, this is the text of his speech talking about global warming versus global greening. And this is really interesting. I had not seen this. I don't know, have you heard this before, Stephen?
I have.
Okay.
It's been used by those who agree with global warming, but that say, hey, it's not as big of a problem as some people, you know, as some of the people have said. And it turns out that especially in northern climates, a little additional warmth creates additional greening. And guess what plants do? They sequester carbon. So
always a good thing. Yeah. Well, it's really interesting because, in fact, Ridley introduces this topic as part of a broader speech where he's talking about the fact that he really resents being called a global warming denialist, you know, because he doesn't like that word anyway. But he says it's nonsense. He absolutely affirms, you know, the research and buys into it and says, yes, this is what's happening and this is what the numbers show. And he considers himself not an alarmist, not a denialist. He calls himself a lukewarmist, he says that, yes, it's happening. Yes, it's going to probably continue to happen, and it's probably not as big a deal as it's being made out. which I think for some,
I have
maybe
to agree with Matt Ridley on at least one aspect of that is the denialist label. It's comparing those who have some problem with the politics or with the science behind global warming and comparing them to the Holocaust deniers. That's where that original language comes from. And
right.
You know, I mean, come on, guys. That's
outrageous.
Not,
yeah.
That's yeah. 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 You know, move past that. That's not cool. So
well, and,
anyway,
and plus, denial is a broad term, and it's applied. I mean, it's a term that's applied broadly to some people who actually do deny that anything is happening, but others like Bjorn Lomborg or Matt Ridley, who don't deny anything, right? They say, no, this is definitely happening. We're just, you know, where we see this all ending up is elsewhere in the spectrum of possibilities that everybody says are possible, right?
Yeah.
Because even if you look at the IPCC, they talk about a range of how this is going to work out, all the way from not a big deal to a fairly big deal. Actually, the big catastrophic stuff doesn't really come from IPCC. It comes from people extrapolating from it, right? So if you look at a range that includes not a big deal to kind of a big deal, and you fall down on the not a big deal, you're not denying anything, right? You're buying right into the whole
there's a range of potential outcomes for global warming, and and Matt Ridley is just saying, you know what, I just don't think that in 20 years we're all going to be dead because of it. You know,
right, and he gives some really good reasons for that around other doom scenarios that have been predicted that have turned right that have ended up being completely wrong. And he says this one seems to fall right in line with those, which is a good enough reason in its own right. But then he points out stuff like this, global greening, right? So you have this thing. In the past 30 years, we've had a 14% increase in green vegetation on this planet. That is astounding, okay? Isn't that good news, right? Back in the 80s, weren't we worried that all the green stuff was going to be gone and we weren't going to have enough oxygen and all that kind of stuff? Shouldn't that be like a huge headline? And yet, not only is it rarely discussed, when it is discussed, it's somebody like Matt, you know, trying to say, hey, could we please look at the other side of this, which people don't even seem to notice. I consider that to be, a fairly big news story. In fact, that's probably the best evidence of global warming that they've got, and they won't use it, right? I mean,
because it's good news.
You know, the temperature data has been kind of problematic for them over the last couple decades or decade and a half or something like that, and you know, they try to finesse it and work it around. Well, here you got this really dramatic thing, and nobody wants to talk about it. But I mean, if you want to say that something is seriously happening with the climate on this planet, there's evidence, right? I think that is some pretty strong evidence that something is in fact going on, and it's evidence, as you said, that the system kind of takes care of itself.
Yeah, because we have additional CO2, and that warms the planet, and plants depend on CO2. So additional warmth plus what they need, CO2, it means more green stuff. And guess what they do? They sequester the carbon and pump out oxygen. That's not bad. Now, you know, what is bad about global warming is that there's a lot of species that can't adapt fast enough. And so we're still in the midst of large extinction events for lots of different different creatures that just can't make the leap. But that's bad news, obviously. But there is some good news too, and it turns out some of the best evidence there is for global warming. And we'll look at that evidence, even if it's not politically correct. So,
well, since no one is much talking about it, the first crazy question that came up in my head was, you know, wouldn't all this greening have a natural cooling effect on the planet? You know, wouldn't this really offset warming to if not a large extent, to at least some extent? And I would expect this to accelerate, right? If the carbon levels, as we discussed on the show a couple weeks ago, really are you know, getting worse and being and staying in a sustained level, then
right.
this greening should only just increase, right? We're just going to see more and more of this.
Right.
Now, the other thing that people predict, the projection shows the temperature's going way up. But maybe the temperature's not going to be the thing that goes way up. Maybe it's just going to be the green that goes way up. Maybe the temperature's going to go kind of up. But what's really going to go up is the amount of greens, you know, the amount of life on the planet.
Well, it could very well be, Phil, that the reason we've had a moratorium, really, in the global warming over the last decade or so could be exactly this.
Right.
CO2 went up. All of a sudden, there's a great greening. And guess what? The temperature, although, you know, we would project it to rise due to the amount of CO2 that we keep seeing going up, it's not. And what in the world could be the cause of that? Well, it could very well be this the increased greening. So, yeah, I would suggest to you it's not getting cooler, but it doesn't seem to be getting warm as fast as anticipated. So that's not bad news.
Yeah, well, and I seem to recall reading something by Freeman Dyson years ago talking about this issue, and one of the things he predicted was he said that as more carbon goes into the atmosphere, you'll see more vegetation on the planet. Turns out that's
right.
true, and that increased vegetation actually makes the atmosphere wetter, not just more carbon dioxide, but more water vapor in the atmosphere, and that water vapor is going to tend to cool the atmosphere generally, and the cooler atmosphere is going to tend to generally cool the planet itself. So, you know, it's this big long cycle that gets kicked off, this kind of corrective cycle that gets kicked off by putting carbon into the atmosphere. And maybe he was right. You know, maybe that's what's happened. And if so, it could very well be that greening becomes yet another strategy for controlling climate.
And the cool thing about this strategy, Phil, is it doesn't require much intervention on our part. It just happens, right?
Well, it's the strategy. It's the Pee Wee Herman strategy, right? We go, I meant to do that, right? And basically, it's all we're doing there. But we can call it a strategy, right? Because it works. But it's really more the unexpected kind of. This is the, as we've talked about before, kind of the upside of unintended consequences, right? Every now and then,
right,
things kind of work out in your favor. So this is a good one to keep an eye on. I want to see if in 10 years, if it's over 40 years, we've seen a 20% or an 18% or 16%. You know, what? How big is that number going to go up? And what's the rise of that number compared to the rise in the temperatures? I think that's going to be a very interesting thing to track.
I think something else that should be tracked is methane. Methane
yep.
Is a greenhouse gas that's with 10 times the potency of CO2. For every bit of methane that goes into the atmosphere, it causes, greenhouse effect 10 times greater than that of CO2. And the plants can't do anything about that. So, there's to the extent that, we need to monitor that even closer. And perhaps our strategy should shift from, worrying about CO2 to perhaps other greenhouse gases like methane that
right.
Need to be monitored a little closely. Maybe move past our initial concern and say, you know what, there are other things that we need to monitor closer, because the planet can take care of the CO2 problem a little better than it can these other things. And so,
well, and in fact, if things are even getting a little warmer, this is one of the really tricky things that you do have to be careful with, which is that at some point it gets warm enough that a lot of methane is released in the atmosphere, and things really can start.
Yeah, and then you have it picks up speed, and you may not be able to get ahead of that. So you don't
exactly.
You sure don't want that to happen. So yeah, got to watch the methane. I would say move past the concern for CO2 perhaps, and look at that a little closer.
Okay, so here's our next unexpected news story. This is solar grid parity. According to the latest report from GTM Research, 20 U.S. states are currently at grid parity, and 42 states are expected to reach that milestone by 2020. So this is big. Grid parity is being achieved. I think before we answer the crazy questions about grid parity, we have to ask one uncrazy question. What exactly is solar grid parity? What does that mean exactly, Stephen?
Well, Ray Kurzweil, his term was solar singularity. with respect to Ray, I prefer the term solar parity, is the idea that, that is the point at which producing energy using solar panels on top of rooftops or wherever you put them is equal in expense to what you have to pay to get electricity off the grid. Now, that's kind of tricky economics because the deal is this, that, you know, once you pay for your solar panels, it's once and done, right? And then you just get electricity off of them throughout until the panels cease to work, I guess, with age. But you have to pay for electricity off the grid on a monthly basis. So it's tricky economics, but, you know, you just do your depreciation. Your accountants know how to do that. And so, at any rate, they looked at this particular article that we were looking at. It's greentechmedia.com. And there is I'm sure, a link in the show notes, right, Phil? So,
of course.
To this particular article, it's 20 U.S. states have reached grid parity for residential solar. And, that's a big deal. When we first started talking about grid parity, I guess 3 or 4 years ago, there was just a few places in the United States that were at grid parity. And, you know, one of them was Hawaii.
Right.
Because they don't have big factories. They were actually getting all of their electricity from diesel. Generators were producing all their electricity before solar. And, you know, they got plenty of sunshine in Hawaii and diesel was an easy thing to beat. And so we reached grid parity there faster than any other place.
What this means is that if you live in one of those 20 states and you go solar, you're going to end up paying no more for energy than you would have, right?
And potentially less.
Wow.
That's right.
Okay. I mean, that's the bottom line.
That is the bottom line.
It was just Hawaii where it was weird economics that made that possible. There were just these few weird outlying places. Now 20 out of 50 states, it's the case today.
Right.
So my
crazy question, if you happen to live in some place that is not one of those 20 states, then, hey, you might want to go ahead and install the solar panels anyway, because 42 states are expected to reach grid parity by 2020. And Phil, 2020 is just around the corner. I mean, it's 3 years away.
Yeah.
So, crazy
question one isn't crazy at all. Is this evidence of the impending solar singularity? This is the solar singularity sneaking up on us, right? I mean, this is it happening, you know? And it's hardly being noticed that solar is becoming this completely viable form of power. I guess the real crazy question we got to look at is number two: is solar about to make other forms of energy irrelevant? Or are we at that point yet? Maybe not, because we've still got the limitations associated with the sun only shines certain hours of the day.
Right.
Some of those kinds of things, right?
So no, the answer to that is no. But I tell you, it's a powerful subsidy to our grid system, isn't it? I mean, it's every electron that's produced that way is an electron we don't have to get from burning coal and putting that CO2 in the atmosphere or other things. So yeah, it's proven to be, you know, the green technology that when I was a kid, Earth Day was just kind of taking off, Phil. You know, it was things that it was both wind power and solar that these guys were kind of pushing. Well, it looks like solar is really paying off, and wind, although it's been ramped up to these huge wind turbines in certain parts of the country, West Texas and places like that, you see them. And by and large, the solar has really outpaced wind as a green energy completely. So, those solar panels, the photovoltaic gets better all the time.
I think the step for our crazy question number two, for that answer to be yes, is the grid itself has to be powered by solar. And for that to happen, we need broader scale solar than rooftops and that kind of stuff. And we need a good way to store it. You get those two things, and then solar starts to make other forms of energy irrelevant. That still sounds like it's a ways off, but I don't know, a few years ago, 20 states being at grid parity sounded like it was a long way off, didn't it? And 42 being at grid parity is very near to now. So, I think, I wonder if we'll be talking about wind at all in a few years. I have a feeling maybe.
Yeah, I just don't, you know, it just doesn't seem like that's going to be a long term. You know, I think that there'll always be people, you know, and there'll always be wind power, but it's not going to be the answer that solar is turning into.
Yeah, it's not going to be as big a thing. Well, with that, believe it or not, Stephen, we've already run out of time, so we're going to have to come back on Wednesday and ask some more, look at some more unexpected news developments and ask some more crazy questions. Look forward to doing that. It's been great talking with you. Thank you all for being with us, and until next time, live to see it.